This is Ryan from So Is It Any Good. This is the new Movie Nerds podcast where we have combined the Movie Challenge and the Movie Cast all into one simple podcast for you each week. We're going to be talking about the Movie Challenge, movie news, and everything movie. This week we've got me, I'm Ryan.
Hey, I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. Hey, guys.
So how is everyone this week?
Doing well, man. How are you?
Pretty great. How about you, Ben? How's the satellite broadcast over there in China?
Yeah, okay. So for listeners at home, obviously I'm not sitting with Ryan and Scott right now.
But you could have been.
I'm actually
you
just down
been holding
the street.
Hands together.
I'm using a tin can and a string.
All right. Anyway, we'll delve straight into movie news. You know, there's been some pretty big bloody movie news this week. Straight off the bat, I'm going to talk about Ben Affleck leaving the Batman movie. There's been pretty big rumors going around that the script wasn't great and, you know, Ben possibly might be leaving. But, you know, this week we got the unfortunate news that he has left the project as being director. He's still going to produce it. He's still going to star in it, apparently, for now anyway. What are your thoughts on it? Ben, Oscar, go with you.
Yeah, sure. I think it's a massive loss, right? So you've got a director who's genuinely exciting, you know, Live By Night aside, and who obviously has, you know, he's playing the character, so he obviously must enjoy it. So it was really kind of cool to see him bring the caliber of directing to the project. Now, I don't know whether he's just afraid if the script wasn't good enough that he would just be subject to more Sad Ben memes after the film comes out. But, like, there's obviously something wrong. He doesn't want the pressure of, you know, doing both, playing the part and making the film. And I think, you know, it's such a key character and it's such a... Honestly, his Batman was the highlight of Batman vs Superman. I thought it was great.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, there's quite a bit of fan hope kind of riding on this film. And, you know, I don't blame him. I wouldn't want to screw it up at all.
Exactly, yeah.
And so if the script's not strong enough, why bother? You know, still play the character, sure, but I think it's a pretty big loss. I don't know who they're going to kind of look to replacing it, and it's always going to feel secondhand, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I got an idea. Jonathan Nolan.
Yeah,
just get that, like, can you imagine? Chris Nolan just wouldn't talk to him. He'd just be like...
Didn't Jonathan Nolan write... I'm probably going out on a limb here, but didn't he write
that? He did, but now he's gone to directing now with Westworld and stuff. Like,
why would you want? I think everyone that's on board for that Batman v Superman, just like other than Ben Affleck, just ship him off. Like, Zack Snyder's lost his cause in those movies. I'm glad they brought in Geoff Johns. I mean, I was just reading today. I don't know if you guys have read it, but there's a new petition to bring in Zack Snyder to direct the Batman, and I don't know what bonkers people
have
started
signing.
It's the
opposite of what people want, right? Like,
I would say that, but this thing,
are we sure that is that not an article by like one of those satirical newspapers or something?
It's actually on change.org, and currently its petition of supporters is 5,392, and you have to consider this is one of those things where it's like not everyone goes to change.org and checks out the latest news. You know, it has to be brought there by some, you know, dedication set of fans. So it's either from Reddit or it's from, you know, websites and stuff like that. But there's 5,392 people going, you know, shit, let's bring this guy in and direct this movie.
Like, how do we even know that Zack Snyder wants to even stay in this universe? I mean, he's put out two pitches with a third coming.
Pitches? Did you just call them pitches?
Whatever. You know.
Let's talk about that.
Hey, I've got a moving picture here.
hey. Golden age, man. But he's put out two of them so far, right? Neither have been, like, super well received. He's made Justice League. Surely that's got to, like, eat into your, you know, your emotional attachment to these films.
What,
like,
movies
why?
Have been well received by him? Can we talk about that? Like, I know that...
Just in general? Like,
yeah, just in general. What movies have
300,
been...
300, surely.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Well, that was probably the last movie. Dawn of the Dead and 300. I think that's probably about it, right?
Because Watchmen was very hit and miss.
Yeah. It was almost like
but
a Batman.
I think Watchmen got more favorable reviews because it was like... I don't know. I think as zombie films always, some critics are just going to turn up their nose at it. Like 300 was just so obviously camp.
Yeah, but it was also very stylistically cool. Watchmen, I think, was a big, like, that was one of those dream projects we never thought would, you know, make it to the screen. And, you know, rightfully so, it's quite a hard kind of graphic novel to adapt. But Sucker Punch, I never walk out of a film, but Sucker Punch is probably one of the closest I've ever been. That movie is atrocious.
Maybe he's just one of those directors that just have, automatically, he's going to have 50% of people liking it, 50% of people hating it. Because I didn't hate Sucker Punch. I didn't love it. Yeah. I didn't hate it, but that was pretty much the same way I felt about Batman v Superman. I didn't hate it, didn't love it, but I kind of liked it.
Oh, everything he's done is better than Sucker Punch. Sucker Punch to me is an emotional black hole. There was no there was no weight to any of those things.
I would love to see that come up onto the trailer. It's an emotional black hole.
Seriously, but
this summer's greatest movie, Sucker Punch.
I was so pumped for all those action sequences, and none of them had any weight. It was just nothing mattered, and then the real world stuff was so damn blase. Depressing, and just. Blah. Not a fun film.
This summer. Blah.
But surely this has got to be a minority fan base who... There are certain fans that I think are just big DC fans that don't want to see their cinematic universe fail. And they probably think Snyder's done an okay job. And I'll be honest, I quite like probably the first half of Man of Steel. And there are parts of Batman v Superman that were alright. I didn't think they were horrible. They just don't have as much... Nothing really grabbed me as much as kind of the Marvel films to have. And maybe it's the aesthetic that everything seems dark and grim. And
the aesthetic's so bad. It's just like you can still have a like dark looking film, but you can have like, you know, just a little bit of like humor in there. And also they're just not coherent. Like they just shoved so much shit into Batman vs Superman. It was so
bad. Yeah, and because they were trying to build towards Justice League, right? And that all those like little clips of him watching Aquaman and then and the Flash.
Surely
show
there had
up,
to be a better way of doing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's all very incredibly forced.
Man, the closest Marvel have come to being that like stuffed with characters and plot was Avengers 2, like Age of Ultron, which I think is like probably the only like miss for me of like the whole series, apart from the Ed Norton Incredible Hulk.
I don't mind the Ed Norton Incredible Hulk, but I agree that the event like Age of Ultron definitely did not. I remember walking out of the first Avengers film thinking it was okay, but retrospectively, I think it's really quite good and really great score. But I don't think Age of Ultron holds up as well at all.
Doctor Strange is my worst Marvel movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to step out there and say that. You can both throw a stone to me. That's fine.
No, it wasn't my favorite by any means.
I don't know. That movie just did not hit with me. But if you did have a choice, who do you think could step in and direct the Batman?
Well, Jonathan Nolan's my joke answer. Just because I think that would be quite funny. Just to piss off his brother. But I'm trying to think of someone who's only hasn't directed like the big action stuff yet and is ready for that. Like the tendency now with like Colin Trevorrow going straight into Jurassic World after doing Section or Guarantee, like one of those kind of indie directors that's ready for that next kind of step into, and someone who's a comic book fan. And the only thing I'm thinking of names, but like the guy that did like Midnight Special.
Jeff Nichols.
What's his name? Yeah, like when I hear interviews with him all the time, and he's a bit of a nerd, but he also like he's been like hesitant to take those kind of jobs, but like someone like of his level, and he's done a few movies now, but someone like that could potentially do an interesting job. Just the same way that Chris Nolan kind of stepped into Batman, and everyone was like, "What the guy that did like Memento is doing Batman? Like, what the hell?" Yeah, someone like that. I mean, you could just get another person whose CV is covered in like action movies to kind of do it, but I think that'd be the wrong move.
I think the real like key attractor for kind of directors with that kind of indie background is going to need to be a strong script. And based on everything that we're seeing, it doesn't sound like it's right there yet. So I'd be hesitant to kind of.
They sound like they want a gun for hire. Like they want a director who can just come in. Someone like Justin Lin, for instance. Who,
yeah, 100%. Who came exactly my example.
Yeah. Because obviously he came in and Star Trek Beyond was pretty far along in the process. And he just took it on board because that's what he does. He's director for hire. Someone like him is who they want. They have a timeline and they want to hit it. So
Yeah, and that's exactly it. That's the problem, is that they've got a devoted fan base waiting for this film, and they really can't screw it up. They can't afford to by any means. So it'll be kind of interesting. The one rumor I've been reading online is Matt Reeves, which I think is an okay choice. He's done a pretty good job with the Planet of the Apes sequel. I thought was awesome, and the new one looks really good. And Cloverfield, obviously. But I just can't think of a director who would be excited about picking up somebody else's sloppy seconds. And then still have him in the lead as well, like, right? Like, and at the same time being stuck in this slightly not yet well received DC universe that they're going to still have to put ties into everything else. I mean, it's supposed to be a standalone film, but these things never are, really. I was reading a lot of rumors that they were going to have tons and tons of villains, and it's just going to be. Yeah. So that itself is going to be a handful. So whoever's going to do this thing, good luck to you, sir, because you've got a heck of a job in front of you.
Yeah, and I think that's half the issue, isn't it? You not only have to deal with Ben Affleck's sloppy seconds, but you also have to deal with you're going up against a Christopher Nolan film.
Yeah,
like, that's what everyone's in mind.
That's a hard fight.
I'm sure that's what Ben Affleck just thought. Well, there's no way I can beat that. Fuck it, I'm done. Yeah, okay, cool. The next bit of news I thought was pretty interesting was Michael Bay has now come out and said that the next Transformers film, The Last Knight, that comes out in June, will be his last. And this is something that Michael Bay has almost said every film after the second one, I believe, that the next one was going to be his last. And it's now up to the fifth Transformers movie. I was wondering if you guys thought there's much to it. Do you think he will leave it? Do you think he's going to hand it over to someone else? Or do you think he's just going to continue on with the other two films that have already been announced to be coming out in 2019 and 2021, I think, or 2020 and 2018?
Yeah.
Or do you give a shit because it's Transformers and really all those movies have been pretty terrible?
Yeah, like after the first one, I think it's kind of been a slippery slope.
Yeah.
With kind of little pops every now and again that were kind of okay bits, but I don't know. He's way more devoted to this franchise than I ever thought he would be.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe he made five. And he seems to like these characters. And I thought the last one was kind of supposed to be a reboot. And he was going to leave it at that. And now he's made this new one. I don't know. I would have thought something like doing like something like Pain and Gain might have just kind of got him interested in doing
something else again.
So it kind of shocked me when he came back to do this one. I don't imagine he probably does leave it after this, but because I can't imagine this movie. This movie will make a lot of money in overseas regions, like in China and whatnot.
Yep.
But unless it's good, I feel like audiences are kind of at their end.
They've had enough.
Yeah.
It's become almost the Resident Evil of toy franchises. That it's gotten so many sequels, you've lost count of which one's which, and they've gotten rid of the original cast kind of thing, and there's only one, you know, solid standing character, and that's the main character, which I guess in this film would be Optimus. Because, I mean, has Mark Wahlberg even shown up in the trailer for this film?
Yeah,
I think
briefly.
He showed up for like very
but, like
2 seconds.
He got the same amount of screen time as Josh Duhamel, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What I don't understand with this film is the whole King Arthur-y kind of stuff and what the heck Anthony Hopkins doing wasting his talents.
Well, I mean, come on, what else has he done? I feel
Westworld, man, he was phenomenal in it.
I haven't caught up for that yet.
I was just saying, like, there's always like a really good actor in there in a Transformers movie for some reason.
Yeah.
Like John Turturro was in like Stanley Tucci was in the last one, and it's just like, I don't know. They just the money is too good, I guess.
It's probably a fun shoot.
Let's be honest.
The budget of this thing is $260 million.
Like
that's huge.
That is
a massive.
That is a massive
film in
a franchise.
That's a fucking ton of money.
But that last movie, Age of Extinction, it made a shitload of money in China.
Massive.
It made close to a billion. Right.
Yeah. Well, they wouldn't be making another one. I mean. And that's why I actually think that's the deciding factor for Michael Bay coming back. Like, it depends how it does. He says things like this, And then if it does really well, he's like, well, fuck, they love me. And then he's just like, he's like, I'll come back. Yeah, I don't believe a word that guy says. Like, I just honestly think, I mean, he comes from a, like, directing commercials kind of background, so.
That's right, yeah, music videos. Right. He directed I Would Do Anything For This, For Anything For Love by Meatloaf, which is probably one of my most memorable music videos from a childhood, I think.
I would much prefer him to do Bad Boys 3.
I don't think he's directing that though,
no,
right?
He's not.
He's coming. What the fuck? Like, you'll do 5 Transformers movies and just like, oh, you know what? I'll leave this bad boy baby.
Joe Carnahan is.
I'm okay with that. I think he's done some all right stuff. So, Smoking Aces and A-Team, right? That's Joe Carnahan.
Yeah. And Narc. And
I haven't seen Narc. Is that any good?
Yeah, Narc is
Silence.
Different. very, very different from those movies.
Oh, but, what's the Liam Neeson battling wolves?
The Grey. Yeah, that's the most. I think that was the most disappointing movie I've probably seen in a long time, because that movie led up to this motherfucker's gonna battle wolves with his bare fists. Let's bring this shit on with his glass hands, kind of thing. And then it cuts to friggin' credit spoilers. Like, fuck you, movie. Fuck you, trailers. Fuck you, Paramount, whoever made that movie. I'm blaming Paramount because they always ruin trailers. And Paramount's making Transformers 5. And I just want to say that the last movie, cannot believe it, made over $1 billion. It made $1.1 billion. How is that possible for one movie?
People love Dinobots.
People are people like bad movies.
Who do you reckon would be good to take over? I'm kind of thinking they'd have to bring in someone with a similar style. So probably Justin Lin or something. You know, director for hire.
The problem is it doesn't matter who Justin they bring Lin. In, right?
I completely agree. This is definitely one of those movies. It doesn't matter.
It does, like,
as long as
Michael
they can
Bay
make explosions,
brings a certain amount of mayhem to the proceedings, right?
Yeah.
But if someone else was to do something different, at the end of the day, you're still going to have giant robots to transform into cars.
That's right. And he's probably going to be producing it too, so he'll probably be seeing in the back behind thing. Come on, mate. Make that in there.
I'm going to say, like, if you can't get Michael Bay, you get Peter Berg. Isn't that what you do? Because their movies,
interchangeable.
They are the same people. I just think that's a clone of Michael Bay in an earlier age. Another thing that's happening, another director said on another movie, is James Cameron is in early talks with Tim Miller to reboot The Terminator. What are you thinking? I'm thinking great things. I got pretty excited. Got a little, you know, my pants got tighter, as I wanted to say. I haven't hated the other, 3 Terminator movies that have come out since Terminator 2. Genesis probably definitely set me aside, and I just went, that is not the best movie that could have happened for this movie. That came down to, I think, James Cameron saying that movie was going to be great. So
yeah, that was a money grab and a half.
Yeah, right. I think they paid him
a lot of money.
Probably Arnold Schwarzenegger's wage for Terminator 3.
So what's the deal here? So he gets the rights back?
He gets the rights back in 2019 because he lost the rights from memory because he was married to Linda Hamilton. Mm-hmm. She had half of it. And then
Galen Hurd, you mean?
Wasn't he married to Linda
Hamilton? He was. He's married to both of them.
Fucking hell, he's smashing to their franchise like no man's business. yeah, you're probably right. It was Galen Hurd. I think you're right. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, because she went off and did the Terminator TV series. And stuff like that. Anyway, whatever the fuck happened with that shit franchise. Yeah, so he's getting it back in 2019. So he's decided that he's going to reboot the franchise and hopefully get in Tim Miller to direct it, who made Deadpool. Yeah, what do you guys think? Is it worth doing?
Nope.
Leave it behind? Leave that series dead and dusted with Terminator Genesis? Or maybe give it one last outing?
Just go make Avatar. Yeah, you get a lot... Yeah, I like, he must be trying to protect himself, right? He obviously loves his franchise and he feels like it's been drilled to the ground. You know, he's come to our Genesis aside. And so he obviously wants to see great things with it. I'm kind of I obviously really love the first two films and I actually don't mind the third so much. I hate the fourth. The Salvation is terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Genesis was whatever. But I just kind of done with this. Like, there's only so many times that, and even a reboot I don't think is gonna do reboot, remake, whatever path they go down to, I feel like it's gonna be ideas we've seen before. And I feel like this franchise is so ingrained in science fiction and it's such like a core pylon in holding kind of science fiction up, and I feel like there's been so many rip-offs and, you know, knockoffs
of all this, you know, whether it's time travel, killer robots, all that kind of stuff. So I'd be kind of curious to see how they try and make it feel new again. And also, the big thing is that Arnold Schwarzenegger is the Terminator. And I don't think he's at an age where he can really lead in that role without... I mean, what they did in Genesis was kind of clever, I guess, but I just don't think he can... He's not an intimidating force anymore, really. No, I agree. And he's so key to that franchise. I have no idea which direction I'd go to kind of cover that base.
I kind of let go of this series a while ago. Like I've seen every film since Judgment Day came out, but with every one, they just cut me a little deeper.
I think the ending of Terminator 3 is incredibly clever.
It's not clever, but it's the obvious ending, and I'm glad I got to see it. There are parts in that film that are not very good, but the ending is quite well done. And I think what ticked me off about the fourth film is that everyone was really excited about this future war, but it was not the future war that they've been showing us for three films.
It was the setup of future war, and it was all daytime.
Put night blue lights everywhere, guys. That's all you needed. And shitty
and
models,
skulls everywhere.
Shitty models flying from the roof, you know, swinging back and forth as they stop.
Exactly. Yeah, look, I'm personally kind of excited about it. Like, I would love that franchise to just kind of go back to its root. Well, it's kind of on its roots, I guess, but like go back to what made number one and number two so great. Bring back the guy that made it, who's James Cameron, obviously, and leave the franchise on a high note. Because I think just to see those two movies, Terminator 1 and Terminator 2, which are fantastic movies, almost flawless in some ways, most ways, and to see it left on Genesis, which I, at the time when I first saw it, I liked it, I enjoyed it, but there was a lot of downfalls to it, and Jai Courtney was probably one of those. But in general, after seeing it again later on, that movie is absolute dog shit. So it'd be good to see this series come back from its crappiness, I guess, and you know, relive one kind of like final outing.
And I mean, Cameron's probably really excited to get his hands back on the rights, right? Because he doesn't want to see his baby kind of drilled to the ground.
Can he not just get the rights and then do nothing with them? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that doesn't make money, man.
Yeah, but he's the king of the world, man.
Seven
like,
more Avatar
he's gonna make
films.
Money.
Exactly.
That's probably how he's looking to fund them, to be honest.
That's why he keeps delaying.
Uncovered something here. That's exactly what's happening.
Avatar is like, this is huge phenomenon when it came out in 2009.
Yeah.
It feels like a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. It was when 3D started. Remember?
Yeah.
Like 3D movies didn't happen before and now they're... Like
I remember reading news articles saying, "Oh, James Cameron Avatar is not coming out until 2009," and I'm thinking that was so long away.
Yeah.
But now, I'm really excited for him to go back to that world because I think that was a film that kind of blew me away when I saw it in theaters, and then it's just dead and dropped off the face of the planet, right? So, if they ever go, and I'm sure they will, but I feel like he's been talking about it for ages. When they get in front of the camera, you know, Cameron doesn't do things half-assed, and so I'm quite excited for that. And with that same mindset, I'm going to guess that whatever he does with Terminator will also be of a certain level of quality. Mm-hmm. Similar, yeah, Deadpool was great. It was okay. But there was nothing about the direction that kind of really stood out for me. But I'm sure he'd be a good person to work with, I guess.
Yep. Yeah, well, I think it's more that Tim Miller is a really good visual director and he can work well with CGI and stuff like that. So I'm not sure exactly where Cameron's going to go, but maybe a future war might be on the cards. I mean, that would set aside not having Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, and it could give us that final look at what the future could look like.
And that's the thing, like if he's really wanting to do a finale, then cool.
Yep.
If you wanted to reboot the franchise so you can go make off a whole bunch more crappy films,
yeah,
I'm less enthused.
Yeah, one yeah,
a finale
that's what
would
I
be
want.
Cool.
Yeah, one last final film to kind of set it off, and then you can do whatever you want, TV series or whatever, but I don't want to see another movie. Yes. Okay. Cool. Well. Okay. That's pretty in the center of what could be happening. I don't know what I'm trying to say. All right, well, cool. Let's get into the movie challenge. This week was week 5, and it was movies that came out in your birth year. For me, it's 1986, and that year didn't really have that many big films, especially films that I thought that, you know, I hadn't seen yet. And, you know, it was the year that Aliens came out, and my brain's gone off into fairyland and cannot think of any other films that came out that year.
There were a couple of... Yeah, Stand By Me. That was actually the number one hit of the year. So
the
my
Fly.
Wife said.
Your wife's coming out with the number one movie of the
year.
She
wanted to see which film we should watch. She said, what was the most popular? I couldn't believe Stand By Me, because that's probably a very... It's a very, very, really cheap movie to make, right?
It's also a very dark movie.
Yeah.
Gun? So that year was Top Gun, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Platoon, Stand By Me, Alien, Star Trek 4.
Oh, that's
everyone gave
Star
a
Trek.
Shit about. Tom Cruise's The Color Money, Big Trouble in Little China, Crocodile Dundee, Pretty in Pink. Big set of movies, but no movies that I hadn't really seen. So I went with the BMX classic Rad. This is the story of Crew Jones trying to join into the BMX Hell Track. It's basically the Rocky of BMX movies, and funnily enough, it stars Talia Shire, who played Adrian in those movies, as the character Crew's mother.
There's actual actors in this film?
There is somewhat. You had it's got actors like Lori Loughlin. I don't know how to say her name. She's from Full House. Plays Jesse's wife. Ray Waltzon, who was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, who played Mr. Hand, if you remember that scene. And then Jack Weston, who was in Dirty Dancing from memory. These are all kind of like those actors that are kind of like, oh yeah, I know that face. What's he in again? Those kind of people. You can't really give them names, but you know, they were in some 80s movies you may have seen. But Talia Shire is probably the biggest actress that's in it, and that's not saying much. The main actor in the movies, his name was Bill Allen, and he played Crew. And Crew was spelt C-R-U, which I thought was interesting, because that was, you know, sets up the whole style of the movie. This movie's kind of like if you mixed Footloose and Rocky into one movie, you would have this film. It's awful, but it's kind of great in the same time. The whole soundtrack is done by John Farnham, and that's pretty amazing in itself.
So this is where, if you've seen Hot Rod, and
exactly,
they play, yeah, so
exactly,
this is where I came from, where they sing You're the Voice.
Yeah.
During that. That's a fantastic sequence in
Hot
Rod.
Well, that song isn't in this film. I thought it was going to be, because I had
really?
I had heard that you know, that had happened.
And yeah, yeah.
That group, Lonely Island, had picked up John Farnham's Rad album. But no,
so how does John Farnham like soundtrack this film?
This is not awesome.
No, it's not. It's an American film. So it's set
How did that happen then?
I don't know. Some little town in America. You know, kind of like Goonies, kind of Amity, and kind of like that kind of stuff. Where it's Goonies is a real town, though, isn't it? Where's that set?
Astoria.
That's a real town, though.
Yeah,
right?
But the place they live is the Goondocks, right? Well, is that what they call it?
Yeah, I think so, because of the Goonies, right?
Yeah.
Oh, fucked up, I know. I need to watch that movie again.
When you say this is set in, like, and they're on BMXing, all I think is that these kids live in the real estate area that was under construction at the end of E.T.
That's exactly, the whole movie is that 5-minute sequence of E.T. The whole thing is like
really?
That. Like, everything is like that movie. It's really weird, because the intro of the scene goes for about 10 minutes, and it's... I think almost like 3 loops of a John Farnham track, and it's like one of those, you know, seminal classics 80s montage sequence tracks, and it goes to the whole opening sequence where these guys are, you know, doing stunts and stuff on BMXs, and a lot of the shots of the film are the feet kind of spinning around on the you know, wheelies and stuff like that, so it does look a lot like the opening of Footloose. And then it finally cracks into the main characters, and they're trying to get away from this cop, but it does very much feel like those 5 minutes in E.T., but with a very small budget. But it's terrible, but it's hard to call it the worst film of all time, because it's definitely worth a watch, because it's just that kind of like, you know, they were just selling BMXs for them to, you know, to make the budget of the movie, and it was only made for people that enjoy BMX riding, kind of like those space movies that they made, like Space Camp, which I think actually came out the same year as this.
Well, I would have watched that again.
Oh man, that movie's awful too.
No,
it is awful. It is
John Wayne's score.
Really?
Yeah.
Holy shit. Oh my god, that's like the smallest part of his career. Yeah, so rad. Not so rad, kind of rad. A little bit.
So have you seen BMX Bandits, Ryan?
I haven't.
Because I feel like it sounds very similar to that, but
I wasn't born, sorry.
That movie tries to have some kind of plot, like there's like kind of a heist thing going on, and there's robbers.
I remember
like
on crooks. The back of the VHS there was people wearing peak masks. Is that a thing?
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, Heat crossed with Rad, basically. But no, that film obviously is on the northern beaches of Sydney, and that has a very 80s soundtrack. And there's parts of that film that are, like, unwatchable. But there's also other parts that are actually quite, like, awesome. So I'd be interested. A double bill of that and Rad together, I think, would be pretty
lock
awesome.
Lock that in. Whoever yeah. owns a cinema. Lock that you've, shit in. Rad and
You've got me intrigued, though. The John Farnham soundtrack I had no idea about. So that's...
It's he's definitely gone, like, I know John Farnham. He's definitely gone for a different kind of sound with these kind of movies. Obviously, it sounds like John Farnham, but it's very much, you know, the better part of You're the Voice, I kind of guess, with the
whoa.
You know, yeah, that kind of stuff. But it's, you know, a mix of 80s montage music.
I promise to never sing again.
No, thank you.
I'm never going to get that out of my mind. Yeah, so...
I think I will check it out. I'm gonna watch this.
Would
movie.
I recommend it? It was hard for me to find. I'm not gonna lie. I illegally downloaded it. I'm gonna
you
say.
Can't
it.
Admit that.
I'm gonna admit it. Well, if look,
who's the production company?
If
does
the production company
the
of
this
film,
if the production company of this film releases it on some form of, you know, purchasable item that I can purchase it, I will. I remember my friend Scott Bond. I'm bringing up on this podcast. This is one of his all-time favorite movies, and he would tell me, like, I think since high school, I've known this guy since, you know, late 90s. I remember him inviting himself to my year 7 birthday party. He would tell me that Rad was his favorite movie of all time, and I had no idea what it was until...
You thought it was a made-up film, right?
Yeah, I didn't think it was real. And then, because he would just tell me, it's this mad BMX movie, I haven't seen a movie till you've seen this kind of thing. And then I tried to watch it, you know, a few years back, and I couldn't get much into it. And I finally had to sit down and do it last night, and it was awful, but kind of good. Anyway, so if someone has it, if there's a production company that still makes this thing and wants to give it to me on DVD, I'll buy it.
Remaster it. 4K yeah, remaster.
We'll do audio commentary.
Fuck yes, we
yeah.
I love to do
theatrical.
Audio commentary. That'd be the greatest thing in the world.
Theatrical re-release, I think, is in order.
Can we put some... digital effects, digital effects in there. Oh, maybe a
Bronto creature.
There's a sequence in the movie where there randomly there's a like a dance. It's not talked about any time before the movie, like any time prior to the dance. There's one short sequence where the main actor crew goes up to this girl and tries to ask her out to the dance. And the way he does it is he does a little stunt on his bike. And he's like, check that shit out, want to go to the dance with me? And she's like, dickhead, fuck off, like, you know, basically that kind of style. And he's like, oh, whatever, guess I'll go by myself then. And then rocks up to the dance, stands in a corner, and all of a sudden Lori Loughlin, whatever her name is, Christina, drags in her bike and starts doing a break dance on bicycles in the middle of the stage, and he joins in, and then it's a dance off on bicycles. It's
that sounds amazing.
Random and amazing.
1986, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. But yeah,
wow.
Rad. I highly recommend it. In like,
expect the worst. So, you know, don't think of it as a Christopher Nolan film. Think of it as a Uwe Boll film or U Boll, whatever his name is, that kind of style, but a little bit better. What about you, Ben? What did you watch?
Well, look, it probably could be said that what I did was predictable, because Ferris Bueller's Day Off, it's one of my favorite films. It came out the year I was born. And we did a few posts about it this week on the website. We did a How'd They Do That. And we also did a top 10 where we did the best end credit sequences of all time. And we named Ferris Bueller number one. So it was on my mind and I had to watch it. So yes, I'd already seen it many times. And I'm guessing we've all seen it.
I've never seen it.
What's that movie, Matt?
I've seen that way too many times.
I think everyone kind of knows the plot of this film. Like, obviously, Ferris Bueller was the poster child for many people
kind of
growing
just
up.
Listen to the title, and you've got the plot of the film almost right.
That's right, and that's why it's such a perfect movie. Because it's, you know, many movies that all you have to do is say the name of the title, and people go, I'd watch that. But yeah, like what I thought, everyone kind of knows the plot of it. I think anyone who hasn't seen it owes it to themselves to watch it, because it's actually one of those movies that I have never met anyone who hasn't liked.
I completely agree with that.
I don't know if you guys are the same, but...
No, I don't know anyone, and I think if I did, I'd probably not friends with them anymore.
Yeah, it's like, one of those films that's just... No one has a bad thing to say about it, right? And everyone... It's a good time.
It's timeless. Timeless movie. Even though it definitely has its 80s moments.
Yeah, that's right. I actually think it might be controversial to say, but I actually think it's the best John Hughes film, even though some people will say Breakfast Club. I think it's usually between this and Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club is overrated.
I'm gonna step up
and say that.
I think it's a different film to this, and I feel Ferris Bueller is much lighter, and I feel like Breakfast Club is way heavier. And I feel like these are the two kind of, it's part of the spectrum of John Hughes, right? But I feel like Ferris Bueller is much easier to just throw on and show people. And I feel like, Breakfast Club's a bit of a, you kind of got to stick with it the whole way through to kind of get what it's trying to get at.
Sorry, Ryan.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, Ferris Bueller, I wrote up how they did that this week, so I kind of know a little bit more about it, but I was shocked to find out that, the movie was made or written. So John Hughes wrote the film in 6 days, wrote his first draft for the film, which is basically the whole film. There wasn't too much changed after that. And it came out this well, like, if I had 6 days to write a movie, it would basically, you know, be a ripoff of some other film that I've seen recently. Like,
Rad.
In my childhood, I ripped off. Exactly. It'd be the sequel to Rad, which I would fucking love to see. Imagine the sequel to Rad now. It'd be fucking hoverboards.
It'd be like called Rad.
Not even Back to the Future hoverboards. Those hoverboards that people just stand on and roll around their rooms with people falling over. That'd be it.
He's got a hoverboard.
He's got a goddamn hoverboard. Don't you know those things don't work on water? I'm sorry.
Yeah, so with Ferris Bueller, I just wanted to ask you guys real quick, like, what's your favorite kind of moment from the film? Because every time I watch it, I'm always just kind of waiting for that end sequence where he's just running through the backyards. Like, I love that music cue. Like, I just think it just ends such a great ending. Like, I actually think it lulls a little bit after they get the car back and they sort of take forever to get home and they stop in that random person's backyard. I can never figure out whose place it is because it's not Ferris's place.
It's Cameron.
Cameron's place?
Yeah.
Right. It always seems to me like they're on their way back to Cameron's place, but that scene isn't at Cameron's place.
Yeah, because, I mean, how else would they smash the car at the back of the window and he's timing it all out and...
that makes sense, but there's like a time jump, though, between those two, like... Those two scenes, we cut away from that, and then we'd come back again in the garage or whatever. But I don't think it's clear that we're anyway. I digress. My favorite scene is the backyard fence jumping scene at the end.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I mean, obviously, of the parade sequence where he sings, you know, twist and shout. But I think my favorite sequence is the sequence between Geoffrey Jones and I don't know her name, but Grace, his secretary. They're trying to sort out him and Ferris Bueller talking on line two and Cameron doing his best Sloane's dad on the phone. I think that sequence between them and him getting freaked out and, you know, where he says, you know, pucker up, buttercup, and all that kind of stuff is flawless. And I'll always love watching that sequence. I always get a great cackle out of it.
There's that great push in on Rooney's face when that you realize that
it's actually where he works it out. I think any time in that room where Rooney's talking to someone, it's always hilarious. Like even when he's talking to Ferris's mom and he's like, look, I've got it right here. He's been away for 9 times. And she's like, 9 times? And then he can see it going, Grace,
Christ.
Yeah. No, it's great. I mean, it's slightly ruined by the fact that that guy was like charged with pedophilia.
Yeah,
like,
he's a creeper now, later. Right?
Yeah, he's an absolute creeper. Let's kind of, I can't really forget about that, can you? It's just always in the back of your mind. Like, you know, he's a principal of the school and you're like, fuck, dude, what are you doing?
I was always a massive fan as a kid of, and it's like a 2 second shot, but when the two parking attendants come over the top of the hill in the car with the Star Wars theme blasting.
It's really the biggest Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah, but as a kid, I love that. And obviously the parade sequence is really good. But I think there's the Cameron character. I mean, we say Ferris Bueller is quite lighthearted, but Cameron is really the heart of that film.
Yeah.
He's especially what he goes through towards the end with his, and the car and his dad and all that kind of stuff. And I really like all that kind of stuff because I was never the Ferris type. I was probably more the Cameron type. So yeah. That was definitely the character that resonated more with me.
Well, he's the emotional part of the film. Yeah. It brings the emotion to the film.
Yeah.
I think if it was just Ferris, then
you kind of get away with everything.
It's too much high. He's a little bit of low.
There's no denying the fact that Ferris is he's a narcissist, like arrogant douchebag, like really.
Yeah.
He's just, but Matthew Broderick just like makes it work.
Flawless in that role.
I can't remember who is it when he picks up Sloane, he's dressed up as a dad and they start making out and then
yeah.
Is it the
Sloane darling?
He's like creeped out by
yeah, weird family.
Yeah.
that's a great movie. That scene always reminds me that I feel like it's almost the exact same costume that he puts on later on for Inspector Gadget.
Yeah,
that sequence is that's the foreshadowing for Inspector Gadget. But have you heard that there's a fan theory that that the movie Ferris's character isn't actually real and it's all Cameron's imagination that has conjured up the character of Ferris to kind of get over his dad and kind of help with his emotions and stuff like that. Have you heard that before? Like, is that my
I've heard it
in your brain?
Yeah, okay. I've heard it and chose to ignore it, but I mean,
like most good fan theories.
Oh, poor fan theories.
I feel like there are films that you can read into and try and come up with stuff like that. Ferris Bueller is not one of them.
Hearing that he only had 6 days to write, there's no way he set aside time, which went, Cameron is a secret element to this movie.
It's just dude ditches school and has fun, right?
Yeah, that's it. Absolutely. Yeah. Never live up to that, though. I always remember going through high school and stuff like that. I was like, this is going to be my day off. And it was just like, went home or went to the movies or something like that.
Well, that's why the film exists, right? To make sure that we all can live that fantasy.
There was never that German parade on in the city that I could go up to and sing Twist and Shout. Always a disappointment. What about you, Scott?
Perfectly.
What did you check out?
Perfectly.
So I was also born in 1986. And so the film, I went through the list of all the films that came out this year, and the one that grabbed my attention the most and was GoBots, Battle of the Rock Lords.
Really?
No. That movie did come out. It was on the list.
I was like, what are you talking about?
It was on the list.
Transformers movie came out that year too.
Yeah.
And it was like,
so of course GoBots had to make a movie, right?
Of course.
I watched Peggy Sue Got Married, which is a Francis Ford Coppola film starring Kathleen Turner and a very young Nicolas Cage, actually his first role. He got Uncle Francis, got him a starring role.
Is that his actually first role?
Yeah.
Was he in, when was Fast Times Ridgemont High? Not to challenge you.
No, please challenge, double check. But anyway, it's a time travel kind of comedy. It's actually very similar to Back to the Future minus all the cool science fiction, the DeLorean time travel, Doc Brown stuff. But essentially, it's Kathleen Turner. She goes to her 25th school reunion for the class of 1960. And she is estranged with her. She's now divorced, I guess, from Nicolas Cage, who was a high school sweetheart. And at the reunion, she kind of passes out and wakes up back in 1960, back in as her younger self. So in that way,
this sounds great.
It's really good. Quite enjoyable. It's so weird to me that this came out a year after Back to the Future, though, because it's very similar. You know, Back to the Future went back to 1955, and now this is in the 1960s. But beyond that, it's very similar. But my favorite thing about this version is that she goes back and does not give a crap. She decides just to live a life with all her knowledge that she has. She starts telling people, "Go invent this, go invent that. You'll be rich." Yeah, she just does not care. She says,
She thinks she's dead, so she's just going to live her life to the extreme as she can. And along the way, she obviously learns about more about Nicolas Cage's character and all that kind of stuff, and learns to love him in new ways and all that. Yes. Oh, he's rocking a sweet, actually a really weird accent and a sweet like mop of blonde hair kind of out the front.
Right.
Very strange from Francis Ford Coppola because it's incredibly light, not a heavy film at all.
But
it's really enjoyable. Kathleen Turner's good. Helen Hunt shows up briefly, and so does Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey's in it quite a little bit.
Jim Carrey's a bit of a shock. This is much before, he's been kind of like breakout with Ace Ventura. And
yeah, so I was looking through his filmography. Right? Yeah, heaps. So he did about four or five films. I don't know how big a role, but before this one. But this is kind of a background character, but one of the kind of core group of friends. Definitely worth checking out. Very, I'd love to know the conversation that Spielberg, I don't know if Spielberg only produced Back to the Future, but if he had a conversation with Coppola about this,
probably one of those things where they're like, they got so jealous of a movie, they're like, I've had this idea for years just flowing around in my head. But they've clearly just rewritten Back to the Future and added a female to the main character.
Yeah, and I think I it was kind of, you take away the Doc Brown and DeLorean and all the sci-fi elements, and someone he basically passes out and wakes up.
Yeah.
And then...
It's not like it's taking away all the rules of that movie.
I think that she wakes up the next... Her first night, she has a really kind of rough time of kind of dealing with and understanding what's happening, but the next morning she decides, I'm just going to live my life to the fullest. And I think that at that point they kind of clean this, wipe slate clean with all the rules and just says, let's go have fun. And I think that's kind of neat because a lot of the time these time travel films have spent so much time establishing the rules and all that kind of stuff that it kind of, it's a lot of effort. And I think this one has a lot of fun with its time traveling stuff. So yeah, highly recommend it. I think it's definitely worth checking out. Good cast, good Nicolas Cage. He's still being very Nicolas Cagey, but he's
very yelly.
And very. Oh, he has a strange accent the whole time, and it's kind of interesting to see him kind of play like this jockey, rock kind of high school kind of dude.
Yep.
It's very much. This is the, almost a forgotten '80s film. Like, don't you think? Like, one of those movies that just kind of.
I heard about it, but I never really understood kind of what it was. And like I knew it was a time travel or had elements of time travel in it, but it's very, very similar to Back to the Future.
Okay, I'm actually keen on checking that. I hope you guys actually check out Rad.
Yeah, me too.
Everyone's seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, so thanks for watching that again, Ben.
Peace Who Got Married was free on Crackle, which is the first time I've ever used that service.
The Sony app, right?
It's the Sony app. Service. Yeah, it had ads, but it was always the same ad for the Jerry Seinfeld comedian show.
Oh, really?
And it was only 10 seconds long.
That's probably the only content they have, right? The real content.
Yeah.
But it's free, bro. Yeah. All right, so Crackle. That's a free advertisement for you.
Yeah.
So I was just going to say, because I do remember him being in Fast Times, but he was only, from memory, he didn't actually have a speaking role. So that's probably his first speaking role. But not that it matters. I was just thought it was an interesting point and to correct you. The last thing I wanted to talk about was a lot of news is coming out about Star Wars recently. A lot of people talking about it. There's this theory going around at the moment, and I will just say quickly, so we did just hear recently that the eighth movie is going to be called The Last Jedi. And obviously people are thinking maybe Luke's going to die. Maybe they're referring to two Jedi because Jedi is a plural for Jedi. it could just mean that Rey and Luke are the last Jedi themselves. Or there's this new fan theory that holds a little bit of flavor to it that Snoke may be the last Jedi. I wanted to see what you guys thought about.
Well, this is the first I've heard of this Snoke theory. So, is there any way you can explain it just as quickly as you possibly can without going through?
Okay.
Because I'll give you the
rundown that a Reddit username Anakin Kajdan has put in, and it's basically it says it was a pretty cool how we saw Jedha in Rogue One, but was there a strategic reason?
What if we were supposed to get that mindset that the Jedi Order is very, very ancient? In one of the most recent Star Wars novels, Palpatine sends someone to Jakku to uncover an ancient secret. In The Force Awakens, we see that Luke is looking for the original Jedi Temple. What's with the sudden obsession with the Jedi history? In The Force Awakens novel, Snoke reveals that he is very old, but we don't know how ancient he is. Kylo Ren's lightsaber is confirmed to be an ancient version of the lightsaber. Where did he get it from? Snoke. Now keep that in mind for the title of Episode 8, The Last Jedi. What if we're learning about the early Jedi because we're going to find out how different the ancient Jedi Order is? What if we were... what if we know as Jedi... are not really Jedi after all? And what if Snoke was the last Jedi in its original form? So what if, basically, from my understanding, is what if the Jedi are actually the Sith?
Something like that.
Like, or just the ancient Sith, yeah. is the actual original Jedi, and along the way, kind of like the first testament, I guess, of the Bible, yeah, to the New Testament, or the Old Testament to the New Testament, a lot of things are different. And not that I read the Bible or anything like that or follow that religion, but what I mean is, like, you know, things have changed and maybe the Jedi Order has changed in that time. So maybe Snoke is one of those original Jedi, the ancient Jedi, and follows a different path, and he's trying to change that path to the new path, which is, I guess, the dark side.
I like that it's a theory, it's an alternate theory to what everyone else has been talking about, because we've all been going for, like, the obvious kind of answer, but you just got to think that if they've released a title this far in advance, like, they know people are going to be talking about this, but it's like, is it something we're not going to see coming, and this is definitely something that would be a left field choice.
But I don't think
so. It's fun.
I don't think Star Wars titles have ever been in the really being about hiding kind of what's on display.
Yep.
They've
been almost very obvious. Except for the Phantom Menace, that makes no sense. But that's a...
It's Palpatine. Or Anakin, depending on how
you look at it. Exactly, that's my point.
But Attack of the Clones, Empire Strikes Back, you know, very kind of corny sci-fi titles. I think this is an interesting theory, and actually I don't mind it. I think it'd be kind of a neat way to go, but people have been... You know, since Force Awakens came out, people have been trying to pinpoint, who's Snoke? If you ever follow Pablo Hidalgo, the Lucasfilm story group guy on Twitter.
Which knows everything.
Yeah, but he's just constantly getting bombarded with, is this person Snoke? Where is this person Snoke? And another Snoke theory is kind of just, there have been a lot of Snoke theories kind of going on. Yeah. But I think this is somewhat interesting. I think I was speaking to you guys earlier about this, but I kind of feel like if they went down this path, it would be very Half-Blood Prince-y kind of thing, where they kind of flip the title and kind of put it to somebody potentially weren't expecting it to be. I don't know if I'm a huge fan of the idea that the Jedi Order, you know, was just not so much bad, but just much more badder than they potentially are. I don't know how well that sits well with me. And I also don't think that the idea that they're suddenly bringing in Jedi and... I mean, we know the Jedi Order is ancient, right?
Yeah.
And even in Rebels, there's kind of been hints of that kind of... Especially when Ezra picked up the similar kind of lightsaber hilt to what Kylo Ren has at the end of Season 2. But so there's kind of these hints that the, you know, a Jedi Order is obviously very old.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily link it to Snoke, though. Like,
no, I think.
But I think it's more saying that and that's why I think it's kind of interesting, is that why are we seeing all these different little things? Like, why are we seeing Jedi? I mean, I know there's obvious reasons why we're seeing it, but like, is there something else behind it? Like, you know, is there a real reason why Jedi is in Rogue One? And is there a real reason why they're saying that Kylo Ren's lightsaber is ancient kind of thing? Maybe there is something. And where, I mean, if you think about it, where the fuck was Snoke the whole of the original and the prequel trilogy? He's an old dude. He's got to be alive at some point.
He's that stormtrooper. It's his head, right?
That was a great one, I thought. The other fan theory is, you know, maybe it's the body of Darth Vader, which... seems unlikely, but it does have the similar scarring, which is quite unfortunate. But I really like watching these or listening to these theories, and this one holds a bit, I think, behind.
Yeah,
it.
This one's got the most bones on it, most meat on the bones, I guess, since that I've heard in quite a while.
Yeah.
Well, it's definitely.
If it is true, because now I know about it, that kind of thing, right?
It's like, goddamn spoils, goddamn.
This is like, I really regret reading all the fan theories for Westworld because. Like almost all of the twists in Westworld were ruined because of fan
theories. I haven't seen it.
But anyway, the fan theories pick stuff up really early.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of taught me to maybe not listen. I mean, yeah. Sometimes it's better to just kind of let the what kind of impact those twists would have had if I'd just gone in cold.
But oh, shit! Sorry about spoiling that for you.
Yeah, until they come true.
You got spoiled in The Force Awakens almost, didn't you? You got told that the making of Star Wars said that
Chewbacca died, and you were shocked when Han died.
Yeah, so that kind of worked in my favor because I thought I'd read something that they were kind of spooky as the truth, and so when it didn't happen, I was kind of surprised,
but it also was kind of gut-wrenching to then have Han die.
Yeah.
True. Yeah, much less lost. I think we've talked about this on another podcast, but I was totally fooled into thinking Chewbacca would go as well. Like, it wasn't until Ryan pointed out that why would you kill Chewbacca when any actor could play him?
Yeah,
that's right. Which made perfect sense.
And he's a good mentor character. That's, you know, he can always be there.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, let's finish up there. You know, next week will be week six. Week six is all about...
Silent films!
Thank you. I was going to have to jump back to the list, and it is about silent films. When I first wrote this list, I'm going to say, when I first wrote the list, I wasn't expecting it to be a podcast. I just wanted to have fun watching different movies every week. And then we decided to make it a podcast. This one's probably not going to hold too much, I think.
I think there's... I'd be interested to see what we all decide to watch because I was quickly having a browse and there's films that are 16 minutes long and there are films that 2.5 hours long. So I'm going to be kind of curious, A, what we can get our hands on and B, you know, what kind of length and kind of type of film we pick. I mean, there's obvious, you know, Charlie Chaplin kind of films or George Millier. So those kind of, and there's a whole bunch of Lon Chaney, like old Frankenstein, Phantom of the Opera. And
all the movies, if you're interested in watching them, all the movies before 1956 have no copyright on them. So you can find them on archive.org, or on YouTube. So, you know, anything, before that time, is watchable for free. But I don't think I've ever seen a silent film. I think the closest thing I've seen to a silent film would be silent pictures that are in movies, like Nosferatu was in Shadow the Vampire, the John Malkovich movie. I think it's John Malkovich. Anyway, and you know, stuff in the Singing in the Rain movies, stuff like that. But in general, I don't think I've seen a full silent picture. How about you, Ben?
Yeah, I was actually going to ask, you know, does a movie like The Artist count, which is actually...
It is a silent movie. I was questioning that before with Scott. That's a silent movie?
Well, it's got a combination. It actually has moments where there's speaking, but it's they do it in a clever way.
Right. Well, as long as it's considered a silent movie, I think that should count. I would not count it. The rule doesn't say that it must not speak the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't watch that one because I need to actually watch something I haven't seen. I seem to be each second week I rewatch something. But just for the listeners out there, like if you were thinking, there probably are a few like modern alternatives if you're not really into the really old stuff. But I would encourage everyone. The whole point of this is to get out of your comfort zone and watch one of those classic films that your film lecturer at uni probably tried to force you to watch and you skip class.
Yeah, I've had Metropolis on my Netflix queue since I've had Netflix. So I'm pretty excited to kind of knock that one off the list and check that one out.
You said that was 2.5 hours, though, right?
Correct.
How can a silent movie go for 2.5 hours? Just, what is happening in that movie for that to go to that?
There's like
distance?
A robot lady.
Yeah, but that's all you know about that, right? And then like the rest of it looks like
what is it, the future world from
from Sky Disney Captain. World. Oh yeah,
no, it's like what's that?
Tomorrowland.
Yeah, Tomorrowland. Yeah, that's it. All right,
yeah,
cool.
there's a
sorry, here you go.
No, I was just going to say, like, there's a lot of, like, yeah, Metropolis, there's a lot of films that are quite long and could be a bit of a punish for you, but so if your attention span's not quite there, as Scoot mentioned, some of the Chaplin stuff might be a good choice as well.
Trip to the Moon is only 16 minutes long. Boom.
There you go.
All right, well, let's leave it there. until next week for Movie Challenge Week 6 and Movie Nerds, the new podcast from us. But so is it any good? I'm your host, Ryan.
I'm Scott.
I'm Ben.
And that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening to us. If you want to check us out more, head to soisitanygood.com, or you can check us out on YouTube with /C/ so is it any good, Instagram and Facebook. We're always here. We're always ready to chat movies. We're all about sharing, liking, and love movies. And that's it from us. Until next week. Peace out.